Well, today we're actually going to take some time and we're going to talk about mothers. As all of us should be aware, Mother's Day 2022 is next Sunday. We're actually having the picnic on Mother's Day. I think it's a Mother's Day picnic. But it's wonderful to be able to have it on Mother's Day. But it will be next Sunday, May 8th. You know, I had not taken a lot of time to study up on the history of Mother's Day. And so I did, and it was actually quite interesting how this national holiday came to be. I had multiple resources I went and looked through and read on. And you know, you can't always believe Wikipedia, so you got to go dig further than Wikipedia. So I went and was able in the encyclopedia and then, of course, history.com and a couple of other locations as well, but it's multiple resources. But I found out that the official Mother's Day holiday began in the 1900s. It began as actually a result of the efforts of a woman named Anna Jarvis. Any of you familiar with her? So I see Richard nodding his head. He knows a little bit about it, which is great. Well, I hadn't, so this was new for me. But it was actually originally initiated by her mother, Anne. So Anna had a mother named Anne Jarvis. And in 1858, she actually started, and this was prior to and during throughout the Civil War, but in 1858, she began this thing. It was kind of an organized women's brigade. And she tagged it Mother's Work Days. And what it was established for was to improve the community sanitation to actually help prevent deaths from disease-carrying type insects and then seepage from any type of polluted water. And so anyway, but then she continued on, like I said, prior to is when it began and then during the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, Anne Jarvis actually used these same mother's work days to help heal the bitter rifts between Confederate and Union neighbors. I found that was interesting. So that was something that her mother, Anna's mother, Anne, did. And so then following Anne Jarvis's death, and that was in 1905, Anna Jarvis, her daughter, kind of began to conceive of a Mother's Day as a way of honoring the sacrifices mothers made for their children in the community. And I found that to be quite interesting. And after gaining some financial backing, she actually got some financial backing from a Philadelphia department store owner named John Wanamaker. I thought that was kind of a funny name. Wanamaker. I knew what I was going to say, and it's no funny anymore, so that's all right. But anyway, in May 1908, Anna actually organized the first official Mother's Day celebration at a Methodist church in Grafton, West Virginia. That's where the family was from, was in the Appalachia area. So that same day, not only was it at the Methodist church, but the same financial backer at one of his department stores, one of his retail stores, had thousands of people attend a Mother's Day event at one of his Wanamaker's retail in Philadelphia. So following the success of her first Mother's Day, Jarvis, she actually remained unmarried and childless her whole life. She never, ever became a mother. I found that interesting. But she was committed to see the holiday added to the national calendar. That's what she wanted. And so she began to write a consistent stream of letters to prominent politicians and newspapers, kind of urging them to adopt the day. And so by 1912, I found this interesting, she had established the Mother's Day International Association to help promote her cause. And by that time in 1912, they say up to 45 states were actually having Mother's Day celebrations at local churches and within the Union. And they began to adopt the holiday. And then her persistence kind of paid off because in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson signed a measure officially establishing the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day. I thought that was interesting history. Was it right, Richard? Mostly. From everything that I read, that's what I gathered from it. But anyway, so that's why we have the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day each year. And it stayed and continued. And I think it's a wonderful day. It, you know, I found interesting that as I was digging through it, there were also Mother's Days that were, but it was totally different. It was the goddess of mothers or something like that that they were used to, yes, that they used to worship at certain times of the year. And this has nothing to do with that. which I found to be interesting. Which was good. As I was doing my research, I was like, oh, that's a good thing because we've been observing it all these years. So anyway, next Sunday, we will honor our mothers and those who, I guess you could say, serve in a mother's role, because there are many of those that do that as well, but old and young alike. For, I guess you could say, in multiple ways, nurturing their families, and not just their families, but even those around them that they're in contact with. So there's much to learn from a mother. And that's what I want to talk about today. I want to focus on how much, what it is that we can learn from a mother. Because there's much to learn from a godly mother. There's much that can be said about a godly mother. And like I said, that's what we will focus on today. And the title for this particular message is The Attributes of a Godly Mother. The Attributes of a Godly Mother. And to dig into this, though, to begin, we have to first understand where women originated. Oh, I think we all know that. But why they were created, where they originated, and why they were created. Then we need to look at what God desires of a woman. We have to have all those things. We have to look at all those things to be able to establish and see the attributes, if you will, of a godly mother. And so we're going to spend a little bit of time on that. And then at the very end, I've got 4 points, or 4 attributes, I guess you could say, of a godly mother. And hopefully it'll be something that we all take in and can consider, because these are things that we're to learn and also to emulate. And you'll see in a little bit what I mean by that, that all of us need to be able to take that in and to be able to respect that, but also to learn from it. So anyway, we'll begin in Genesis 1. Who would have guessed? Genesis 1. Genesis 1, verse 26. You know, it's interesting to note, even though I've read this many, many times, and no doubt all of you have as well, but I don't care how many times I go back through Genesis 1, I go back through Genesis 2, I go back through Genesis 3, or you just go through the scriptures, period, the things that you glean. I mean, you can go back to Genesis 1, 2, and 3, and you can literally take it and find something almost, and I'm not saying it's a new truth, but I'm saying understanding something a little bit deeper than maybe you did before. And this kind of the same thing with this. So, and as I go through this, some of you may say, well, I already saw that. Well, that's great. But I didn't. So anyhow, as we go through this, hopefully it'll be interesting to you as it was to me. So Genesis 1 verse 26, we're told, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. That's where we start, verse 26. So there's 2 words that we need to look at here. 2 words, and both of them are image and likeness. Image and likeness, because they're not the same. They're not the same word. They don't have the same meaning. The Hebrew word for image is selem, and it's S-E-L-L-E-M, selem. And S-E-L-E-M, I'm sorry, I spelled that wrong, S-E-L-E-M. And it means to be of resemblance or representative figure. That's interesting. A resemblance or representative figure. It also means a phantom or an illusion. In other words, it's something that but is representative of something else, someone that is representative of someone else. Keep this in mind as we go through it. The next word is likeness. And this word in the Hebrew is demuth, D-E-M-U-T, demuth. And it means shape and appearance. Shape and appearance. So two different words, two different meanings, image and likeness. Sometimes you think of those words, image and likeness, it could be the very same thing. But and what's interesting is when we go to verse 27, likeness is not mentioned again. It's only image twice, and it's the same word, selem. And the likeness, though, he brings this out when God says, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And too many people I've read in different commentaries and such like that, they say that God has no shape or form. He just doesn't. And right here, I read that he does. I read that he has shape and form, and we are in that same shape and form. That in itself is interesting. And we read in Scripture where it's hand, you know, where God has a hand, his ears, you know, his feet, things of that nature. What he can see, his eyes. So I mean, there's all these different scriptures that disprove that particular theory. They say, well, that's just an allegory, you know, or whatever. It's just an example of what it is that they're trying to explain. They're using it as an explanation. No, it's not. God has a shape and a form. He does. And we are modeled in that. Exactly what he looks like, I don't know. But I think we have a pretty good idea, somewhat of an idea. So that's the likeness. But the image is something different. Like I said, in verse 27, God mentions this, or God has it recorded twice. So God created man in his own image. And like I said, his own resemblance or representative figure. That's what that word image means, the same word tselem. And he goes, of God, he created him. Actually, go back. So God created him in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. And then he says, male and female, he created them. Male and female, he created them. So he created them both, male and female, in his image, in his resemblance, or his representative figure. God created both male and female as representative figures of him. Representative figures of him. They made man inclusive of male and female in their image. Like I said, likeness is describing form and shape, or our appearance, but image is describing what they are like on the inside. What they are like on the inside. You know, how many times have we heard, we are ambassadors of who? Jesus Christ. We are to resemble our Father in heaven. Jesus Christ even said, if you've seen me, you've seen my Father. Was he talking about the way that he looked on the outside? No, he was talking about the way he was on the inside. What it is, how he acted, how he reacted, and the things that he did. You've seen me, you've seen the Father. So kind of the same thing. So a representative figure is someone who acts in a way that represents whom they serve. I think that's the best way to explain it. A representative figure is someone who acts in a way that represents whom they serve. But what is interesting, as I was going through this, God made male and female with differing attributes. He just did. Woman came from man. You can go back in Genesis 2 and you can read that. And God created them to be connected. And I find that's interesting as well, because God took, how did God create Eve? From Adam's rib. And you look at that, and that particular word, it means the side. She was to be, if you will, they were to be beside one another, his side, to be at each other's side. God created them to balance each other out, to complete one another. The two would be one unit, and that's how God intended it, for man and woman to come together and to be one unit for the good of both. They both were created to possess attributes, and this is how God intended it to be, that man would have a certain attributes, and women would have certain attributes. Now, they would have similar attributes as well. But there are certain attributes that the men will have a stronger pull to, and the women will have a stronger pull to. That's just the way God created it. It's interesting how that is. And it is the qualities and the image of those them being representative figures, they're representative figures of God, these attributes that they have, both women and men. Think about that for a second. So God has given what it is that he's like, he's given to both man and woman, but some more so into woman and some more so into a man. Together they make a complete unit. Why do you think God created family? For that very reason. So that we would complement one another and build one another. I think it's absolutely beautiful whenever you begin to think about it like that. And in verse 27, when I was reading it this past week, I was like, well, that just makes sense. To me, anyway. Maybe I'm not explaining it the way that I should, but at the same time, that I just felt like this was just absolutely beautiful to me, to be able to see that God gave different attributes to men and to women, but it encompasses what he's all about as a whole. The man had a responsibility, and the woman did too. And I believe those responsibilities would have been different if decisions would have been made differently in the garden. I do. But even though they made the wrong choices, it didn't change the representative figure God intended them to be. Yes, it changed their responsibilities, because they were to tend the garden. Remember? They were to tend the garden, but then what happened after they sinned? They were then sent out of the garden. And it says you're going to tend the dirt from which you were brought forth. That's what they're going to do. And they continued to be, if you will, it didn't change. It changed their responsibilities, but it didn't change the representative figure God intended them to be. Because what God intended them to be all along was to be like Him. That's what it was to be. And like I said, they were to act in a way that represented whom they served, and that was God. And you can go back, Genesis 3 and verse 23, and you can see that they did serve God. They served at His pleasure, if you will, because when God says, He says, therefore the Lord sent him out of the Garden of Eden. He says, to till the ground from which he was taken. Sent him out. They had to leave. They couldn't stay. They had to do what it was that God instructed them to do. So they were at His pleasure, of course. We understand that. And you can go on. You can see how, like I said, the responsibilities changed. But like I said, them being the representative figure that God wanted them to be did not. But yet, at the same time, that did change just because they weren't seeking God and all of that. And you can see what happened back in Genesis 6. We don't have time to go through there right now. But at the same time, that changed. They changed it. God didn't change it. Man and woman changed it. But many years later, the Apostle Paul wrote to Titus. And so we're going to jump from here now. We're going to go all the way back to the first century church. And we're going to go and look what Paul wrote to Titus. You can go ahead and start turning there, Titus 2. But Paul wrote to Titus about the qualities of a strong congregation. And within this congregation, within this description, he then describes the attributes of a godly woman, if you will, a godly mother. Not just a godly woman, but a godly mother. Titus 2. Titus 2, verse 1, he says, but as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. And then he goes on to explain what it is that should be visible within the church, within the local congregation of the greater church of God. Should be in all of the congregations, but in this one particular congregation that he was talking Titus about. He says that the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith and love and patience. The older women, likewise, that they should be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to too much wine, teachers of good things. That these same older women, that they would admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands. It says that the word of God may not be blasphemed. We'll stop there. There's much more that you can read, but I just want to go to that particular verse. But as we look at this, we need to actually define these five attributes that are actually listed here. To be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, and obedient. We need to look at those and see exactly what that means, because they can actually be taken and misconstrued. They can, and too many times they have. They've been misconstrued. But first, before we do that, we need to look back at verse 4 in the King James Version. I like the way that it mentions it in the King James Version. It goes on to say that they may teach the young women to be sober. That's important, because this word sober, what it means is self-controlled. That they must be self-controlled. They must be of a sound mind to be able to, you know, be, if you will, control of their life, their mind. That's how it brings it out. But if you notice here in the New King James Version, all it says is that they admonish the young women to love their husbands. That's actually left out. And if you go into the literal translations, you'll see where to this particular part of the passage is still there. And it's in the King James Version, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, and to love their children. And I've wondered, I can't find anything about it, but I've wondered if they've left it out because they think that this word sober, it means of a sound mind, but they've also defined this next word that we're going to look at, the word discreet, as a sound mind as well. And they thought, well, there's no need to double it up, you know, say it twice. You need to teach her to be of a sound mind, to love her husband, to love her children, and then she needs to have a sound mind. And I don't know if that's why they pulled it out or not, but I did a little digging to see what this word discreet, if it meant the same thing as this word sober, as is in the King James Version. And they do not mean the same thing. They are derived from the same word. Actually, the word this word sober in the Greek is sophrizo, and it is sophrinizo, and it literally means, like I said, sound mind. But it is derived from this next word, discreet. And so when you take this word discreet and you break it down, you'll see what is being meant here. It's not sound mind, sound mind. It's actually something else. The word discreet, in the Greek is sophron. It sounds a lot, it resembles it quite a bit. But this word is spelled S-O-P-H-R-O-N, and it means, this is how it means just right off the bat, sound mind. But as you go in and you start looking at it, this word is actually derived from two Greek words, sozo, S-O-Z-O, and phren, P-H-R-E-N. And if you take those and you put those together, as most of the times whenever you take Greek words and it's from two different Greek words, and you have a word that's being translated from two different Greek words, it's actually those two Greek words together that make up the word. And so this word, sozo, means to protect and preserve. Protect and preserve. And phron means sensitive nature. To protect your sensitive nature. That's what the word discreet means. So in other words, whenever Paul was explaining this to Titus, he was telling the older ladies, he says, admonish the young women to be sober, to be sound-minded, to love their husbands, to love their children. And then he says, but to also protect and preserve, when he says discreet, protect and preserve her sensitive nature. That's a quality that God, an attribute that God gave a woman, is a sensitive nature. And we'll touch on that a little bit more as we go along. But we're going to finish defining these words. The next one he says is to be chaste. Chaste. And the Greek word for chaste is hagnos, H-A-G-N-O-S. And it means to be innocent. And it means to be pure. And so, exciting, I found this one interesting, exciting reverence. To be chaste, to be pure, to be innocent, exciting reverence. In other words, stimulating respect because of proper actions. That's what chaste is. Stimulating respect because of proper actions. So we have discreet, which is protecting and preserving that sensitive nature. You're doing things that stimulate respect because of proper actions. And then this one. This is one that has really been misconstrued. Homemakers. Homemakers. There's nothing wrong with a homemaker. Not at all. But there's too many times I've heard, well, you work outside the home, you're not a homemaker. That is totally false. It's absolutely false. This word homemakers, in the King James Version, whenever you look at the translation there, it says keepers at home, or keepers of the home. That's what that word actually means. This does not mean what one thinks, though. The Greek word is oikouros, oikouros, O-I-K-O-U-R-G-O-S, oikouros, and it means to guard. It means to beware, and it means a keeper of the home. This is actually derived from the Greek word oikos, which means household and family. This particular word, homemaker, is better understood as a guard or keeper of the family. A guard or keeper of the family. Like I said, I found that very interesting. Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary describes this phrase as keepers at home as guardians of the house. Guardians of the family. And as we go along, you'll see what I mean as we go forward. The next one it says is good. I know we read and we say, well, no one's good but God. Absolutely. But this word good in the Greek is agathos, A-G-A-T-H-O-S, and it means pleasant and joyful. Pleasant and joyful, honorable and respectable nature. So the wife is to be joyful and pleasant and of a respectable nature. The next one's obedient. This one, too, has been misconstrued many times. The woman is to be under the hand of the man. And that is not at all what God ever intended. It's not. And I've heard that time and time again. The word submit has been totally, totally used in the wrong manner. It has. This word obedient in the Greek is hupotasso. Hupotasso. H-Y-P-O-T-A-S-S-O. And it literally means to submit oneself. But many times the word submit has been taken out of context. And this is where I want to, if you will, kind of help us all to understand what it really means. And the word hupotasso is actually derived from two Greek words, hupo and tasso. How about that? Hupotasso. Hupo and tasso. And hupo means to be under, with, and this is where sometimes all we look at is the under. But it also means with or in. With or in. Tasso means to determine, ordain, or assign, or arrange in an orderly manner. Hupotasso should be better defined as being under, with, or in a certain order. Under, with, or in a certain order. When a wife submits, see, this is where, and I've mentioned this to those that I've ever given marriage counseling to, like pre-marriage counseling, before they go into getting married, and we go over the marriage vows. We talk about that because, you know, in because Paul even mentions, and Peter mentions, that wives should be submissive to their husbands. Absolutely. God has ordained that. I mean, absolutely. God has established the man, and we're going to touch on that a little bit here as well, but God has established it this way, but there was something else that he was trying to get us to understand, and we're going to, like I said, we'll go back to 1 Peter here in just a second. But when a wife submits, she is actually giving herself over to her husband, because before that, you have to understand, before that, who does she submit to before she ever gets married? God. That's it. Her parents. She submits to her parents. Or a man that does the same thing. They submit to their parents when they're underneath their roof. They submit to their parents. Honor their father and mother. Well, when you're out on your own, you're the head of your family. You are. When you get married, guess what? You then become under the name. And that's why the name gets taken. Like, for instance, Amanda was Amanda Taylor. And I was Nathan Willoughby. Then whenever she married me, she came under my name. She became under, if you will, and we're going to talk about this, under my protection. It was my responsibility. She then became, if you will, I became responsible. Together we're responsible for our family, but I am ultimately responsible for the family. Does that make sense? But at the same time, the word submit means that she then says, well, I'm giving myself over to my husband, and I trust him with my life. I'm trusting him that he will love, that he will care, and that he will cherish me. And in turn, she's willing to be led by and work with, and see, that's, it's not just led by, it's led by and work with, led by and work with, alongside of him for the good of the family. That's what submit means. And so I guess you can better understand this particular passage right here in Titus 2 because of us defining these words. And I feel like it could be translated this way. Verse 4, teach the young woman to have a sound mind. Teach them to have a sound mind, to love their husbands and their children, to preserve their sensitive nature, be innocent beyond reproach, stimulate respect, be guardians of their family, be joyful, pleasant, honorable, and one that is trusting and willing to work for the good of the family alongside her husband, that way the word of God will not be spoken evil of. I feel like that's a better, helps us to understand what's being said right there. And now, because of taking that and understanding that, like I said, we're building on this so I can get to the point of the attributes of a mother. And so next is 1 Peter 3. 1 Peter 3. We're not too far away from 1 Peter. So 1 Peter 3, verse 1. And so as we now understand what the word submit and be submissive means, whenever we go into this passage when Paul says, likewise, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. He doesn't say to all men. He says to your own husbands. Your own husband, not somebody else's husband, your own husband. That even if some do not obey the word, and talking about the husbands, even if they don't obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. Just because of the way their wives are exactly of what it is that Paul was explaining to Titus. This is how a woman is to be. This is how her attributes. This is what they're supposed to look like. It goes on and says, do not let your beauty, and he's talking to the women, be merely outward. Don't let it just be outward. Yes, a woman can be very beautiful in the way that she dresses and the way that she presents herself. He says, don't let it just be outward, adorning of arranging the hair, wearing of gold, putting on fine apparel. Don't let it just be that. He says, but let it also be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit. And some have taken this and said, well, a woman's just to be quiet. No, that word just means peaceable. A woman who's undisturbed. A woman who's peaceable and undisturbed, which is very precious, we're told, is very precious in God's sight. And then you drop down to verse 7. It says, likewise, you husbands, dwell with your wives with understanding, giving honor to the wife. And this is interesting as well, and we're going to touch on this. Giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and being heirs together. And that itself, we were both men and women, were created to be heirs of God's family. We were created equal in that regard to become heirs in the family of God. What does it say? What are we told? There's no male. God isn't male or female. He's not. And it says there won't be any giving of marriage of those in God's kingdom. So what it is that God is trying to explain to us, and what God wants us to see between a husband and a wife, is the relationship that God wants to have with us. All right? And so whenever he created woman in the same similitude, if you will, in the same likeness, but different form for sure, which is great. I'm appreciative of that. They don't look like me. They look like a woman. You know what I'm saying? But at the same time, God has done the same thing for us together. And he says, going on, he says, as to the weaker vessel and being heirs together, the grace of life, that he goes on to say, your prayers may not be hindered. You notice that Peter says weaker. The weaker vessel, that's right, both man and woman are weak. They're weak. Both are vessels to God. But Peter says that she is the weaker vessel. So both, but the woman is, if you will, I guess sometimes this isn't translated properly, because when you think about weaker, she, and I will say in certain ways, absolutely she is, but the woman is more delicate. I think that's the best way to put it. The woman is more delicate. Her frame is not built like a man. It's just not. It's just not. And their muscles are not built as a man's muscles. Yes, some women's are, because they just have. I look at my oldest daughter. She's built. She CrossFits every day, except on the Sabbath. She still does it Sunday through Friday. She just does. She could bench press me, I'm pretty sure. But at the same time, her frame still is not built like a man. And her muscles aren't built like a man's muscles. If a man did the exact same thing that she was doing, he'd bulk up bigger. He just would. That's just the way it is. A woman's shape and her frame and her and all of that is more delicate than a man's. And like I said a little while ago, their shape is not like a man's, and they are different, and I'm glad about that. And I imagine every man in this room is glad about that. Absolutely. But the woman complements the man, and the man complements the woman. It just does. Together, as one, they make up the image of God. Together. Get it? Together they make up the entirety. Well, I mean, not fully, but they make up what God is all about. They make up what God is all about. Alone, they only display part of the image of God. Together, they make up the image of God. So one more passage to finish setting the foundation for the remainder of this message. Ephesians 5. Then we'll get into the rest. Ephesians 5. But I felt like this needed to be established before we ever went into the attributes of a mother. I wanted everyone to understand what a mother is and why God created her the way that he did. Ephesians 5, verse 22. It says, wives, submit to your own, here it is again, your own husbands as to the Lord. Submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, and this word subject literally means to be subject oneself to. It says, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. He says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. So as the head of the church, Jesus Christ leads, he provides, and protects, doesn't he? That's what he does. He leads, he provides, and he protects. And we, in turn, are to be the complement of that. We're to be the complement of that. What did Jesus Christ give us? What did he tell us to do? Whenever you go back to Matthew 28, and you can also see it, I believe, in you can see it in Acts. He gave us a commission. He gave us a commission to do what? Preach the gospel and to prepare a people. Preach the gospel into all the world, making disciples. Preach the gospel and prepare a people. That's what we're to do. So in other words, we are in turn, as Jesus Christ is the head of the church, he leads, he provides, and he protects. And we in turn, as the church, are to be the selfless planners, the teachers, the organizers, the nurturers, and the comforters. As, guess what? The bride of Christ. As the bride of Jesus Christ. So in turn, what Paul is actually saying here, husbands are the family lead. Says they are the head of the family as Christ is head of the church. So they are the family lead. They are the providers, the protectors. And mothers are usually the family planners, the organizers, the nurturers, and the comforters. They just are. They are. And what's interesting is many times we focus on how God leads us, how God protects us, how God provides for us, which is great. It's absolutely what we should do. And that's attributes a father is to bring to the family. But not always do we focus on the attributes that a mother displays, which are also qualities of our great God. They are. And qualities that God wants us as men and women to actually gain from one another. It's interesting how God has established this. It really is, and what it is that God wants us to be a part of. Because whenever Jesus Christ returns, he's going to do what? He's going to marry the church, if you will. Why do you think God has established a husband and a wife? It's to show what the family of God is all about. Because what are we going to be doing? It says that we're going to be made in his image. In other words, we're going to be like him. We're going to see him how he is. And what are we going to do? He's going to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And we are going to do what? Assist him, aren't we? And that's how God has established his family, the physical family, for us to better to understand that. So, for the remainder of the message today, we're going to look at the qualities of our great God that we don't normally look at, but they're also the qualities or attributes that a mother displays that actually reflect the more delicate image of God. They reflect the more delicate image of God, because I believe it's something for all of us to consider, something for all of us to take in and understand. For a mother or a woman, you're gonna say yep to most of this, and some of us guys are gonna be like, I probably need to be better in that. It's just because that's just how it is. You know, I've got four, but one of them is one that one day won't be a thing. It just won't. And when I get there, you'll understand what I mean. But the first one is this, gentleness. God is gentle, and mothers are too. God is gentle, and mothers are too. You know, think about it for a moment, how a mother takes care of an infant child. How gentle and caring she is. How much she's concerned about every detail. You know, I know that when I would watch Amanda tend to our children, you know, when they were infants, when they were little ones, how gentle and tender she was when she changed them, when she clothed them, while she was talking to them, as she was bundling them up. I remember watching that and seeing it happen, speaking softly to them the entire time. It was a joy to see, especially now thinking back on it. You know, yesterday as I was putting this message together, I teared up a few times because I thought, you know, I took that for granted. I did. Too many times I just, oh, that's her job. When I could have learned something from it. And I think I have as time has gone on. But at the same time, it's something that I feel is something that a mother, what they do and the tenderness that they have and the gentleness that they have is not what a dad has, always. It's just not. It's not. I guarantee that most of us dads don't have a mama's touch. We just don't. Because we're a guy. We're a dude. And we just don't have a mama's touch. We don't. But a mother displays the gentle qualities, the gentle attributes of our great God. I want to go back to Psalm. This is beautiful and tender words of our Creator. Psalm 139. Psalm 139, verse 13. He says, "For you..." This is David explaining God and what he's like. He says, "For you have formed my inward parts. You have covered me in my mother's womb. He was had that much care. He has that much care for us that that's what he does. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. The great God of the universe who created the heavens and the earth and the stars and the sun and all these things that are just powerful things. He's created the angelic beings. He then also creates the most small human being formed in the womb. Think about that for a second. How delicate that is and how gentle he is. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought, skillfully built in the lowest parts, he says, of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance, he says, being yet unformed. And in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. God had already transcribed what it was his little life was going to be like, or what he was going to be like, and what he had planned for him. That's what we do with our own children. I know whenever Amanda, whenever she was pregnant, she was more so into it than I was. Yes, I was always like, yeah, that's a good name. Or no, that's not a good name. But she had everything figured out, because this was a little child that she was carrying. It was our child. And her mindset was a little different than mine. Mine was to go out and got to make money. We got a kid coming. And she was all about preparing for this little child. And that's what God does for each and every one of us. That just shows the attribute of a mother. It has it written all over it. It just does. It's beautiful. Deuteronomy 32. This is before the children of Israel go in to the promised land. And well, how God looked at the children of Israel. In Deuteronomy 32, verse 10, it says, he found Israel. This is Deuteronomy 32, verse 10. He found Israel in a desert land, in a wasteland, a howling wilderness. And God encircled Israel and instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. That focused on his chosen people. He says, as an eagle, and many of you can probably visualize this, as an eagle stirs up its nest. An eagle has huge talons and a beak that can rip flesh. But yet an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him, and there was no foreign God with him. I mean, that just shows, this is how God treated Israel, how he was very gentle with them, how he wanted them as his people. And he does the same thing for us today. He just does. This is how God cares and tends for us. And this is just as a mother cares and tends for her children, gently. Gently and with care. Mark 10, verse 13 through 16, we won't turn there. But this is where the little children were coming to Jesus Christ. And what did the disciples do, which I might add were all men? What did they do? They were running them off. They're like, shoo, get out of here. And Jesus says, no, let them come. He picks them up, puts them on his lap. It's the same God. And that is how the Father and Jesus Christ display tender, gentle care for their children. Just as a mother does. Just as a mother does. The second thing, compassion and care. Compassion and care. God is compassionate and caring, and mothers are too. God is compassionate and caring, and mothers are too. Psalm 56. Let's go to Psalm 56. Psalm 56 and verse 8. I love this passage, and so some of you probably know it, and maybe some of you don't. This is just talking about God, how he has compassion and care. Verse 8, just one verse here. And this is David, he wrote this. He says, you number my wanderings, and you put my tears into a bottle. Are they not all in your book? God cares. God cares. He has compassion, and he takes notice. As David says here, our tears and our sorrows. He is there to listen and to help in our times of need and distress and need. God is there. And guess what? Mothers do the same thing. They just do. I know this personally. It's been many times. That I remember going to my mother for that care and compassion. And many times our own children would go to their mama in their times of sadness and distress, and they still do. They come to dad for some of the hard things. They always go to mom for the compassion and the care. You know, I know whenever our kids were younger, they'd fall, they'd get hurt or whatever, and it would either be, when they would fall, it would either be out of sheer embarrassment that they fell, and depending on where it was, if they were younger, or it's because of a scrape or a cut. If they hurt themselves, it could have been their pride, or it could have been because they scraped or cut themselves. But the very first person they looked for was mama. And if mom couldn't be found, dad was second. Dad was next best. It was always mama they'd go to. Not dad, but mom. Mom had the compassionate words and the comforting touch. She did. And if you watch these little ones, I've seen it. I've watched it in some of the congregations that we've been in. The little one will fall. First person they'll run to, straight to mama, grab her leg. Looking all over for mama, sees dad's, grabs his leg. His first mama. That's just what happens. And the tears will be wiped by mom, and the boo-boo would be kissed, and everything would be good again. Just would. But you know what? This never changes. It only matures. It never changes, it only matures. And the same is true for our loving Father in heaven. This type of compassion and comfort never changes, it only matures. And our mothers display this, and sometimes they display it on a daily basis. They do. Doesn't matter how old their kids are. They can be a baby infant, or they can be 50, 60 years old. Just the way it is. Isaiah 49 kind of helps put a point on this. Isaiah 49. Isaiah 49, verse 14. It says, but Zion said, the Lord has forsaken me, and my God has forgotten me. But can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget, yet I will not forget you. I don't know how many mothers that would forget their nursing child ever. I don't. At least good mothers. You know, God's making a very direct point here. He's saying that his compassion and concern for Israel was that deep. So much so that it was as if they were, and if you continue reading, I shouldn't have stopped, but in verse 16, it says, see, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands. I haven't forgot about you. Never will. I've inscribed you on the palms of my hands. God's saying that his care and concern for them was so deep that it was as if he has inscribed them on the palm of his hands. He'll never forget. So true and godly mothers are the same way with their children. Nothing will keep them from being there for their family, for their children. You know, much is said in Proverbs 31 about the habits and focus of a woman who has compassion and care for her family. It's there. I encourage you to read it in the next week or so, especially as we come into Mother's Day. And think about your own mother, your own wife, or that woman who may be in your life. Think about the women or the woman in your life that cherish, comfort, and care for you and how they go about it. They show it. They show that same attribute that God shows us. All right, moving on. I've got to move on. I'm taking too much time here. Number three, and this is the one that I said is something that'll fade away one day, but it's real. It is real, and we can learn something from it as well. We should. Because it's something that we should desire not to put our mothers through. And that is grief. God grieves. Mothers do too. Yes, we all grieve. But mothers grieve in a different way. You know, I've witnessed grief of a mother like I said, fathers grieve as well, but not like a mother. You know, I've witnessed grief of bad decisions of their own children, grief of a disintegrating relationship with their child. Grief of a mother is real. And a godly mother grieves in the same way that our loving God grieves. He just does. They just do. And this is an attribute God gave them. And Genesis 6, in verse 5 through 6, it says that the Lord was grieved in his heart. Remember, this is whenever the people had gotten on the earth had gotten so terrible. Sin was just out of control. And it said that he grieved him that this has happened. It grieved him. The word, it grieved him, it says in the New King James, the Lord was grieved in his heart. In the New King James, it says it grieved him at his heart. In other words, God was grieved all the way to his heart. I like the way the New Living Translation translates that. It says it broke his heart. It broke his heart. And many times, God's heart is broken by the things and just the way that by his children that turn away. His children that disregard him, his children that disrespect him, the children that leave what it is he's called them to. It grieves God. It does. And that's all pretty telling of how God looks at those, and that grief that God has is pretty telling of how God looks at those who turn their backs on him and his way of life. When he loses something that he had wonderful plans for. But, you know, this is the way a mother is with her own family. Sometimes it's sad. It is. But it is truly a representation of the very image of our great God. You know, mothers grieve when they see their own children making the wrong choices. I said fathers do too. But they grieve in a different way. Mothers grieve when they witness these things of their children, when things happen in their children's lives, whenever they make the wrong choices. Like I said, fathers do too, but not like a mother. You know, a mother carries her child for 9 months. 9 months. They birth that child. And there's a bond with a mother and a child that a father just doesn't have. They just don't. I know, because I am a father. I'm a dad. You know, I love my children deeply, and I would do anything for them. But I don't grieve over things like Amanda does sometimes. And I've seen her grieve over things of our children that just, it's on her mind, on her mind, on her mind. Me, I'll put it away. I know it's there. I'll handle it. It'll, you know, take it as it comes. But it bothers her. You know, it's because a mother will have taken care of this child, nursed this child, and done things for the child the father just hasn't done. There's a closeness that only a mother can have to a child, and it is the same closeness that God desires with us and that God has with us, a closeness that is tender, caring, comforting, gentle, and yes, sometimes it's grievous. But always, a mother always has a hope of change for a child, always. For the child to come back, to have that relationship, the opportunity to see that child again or whatever, however the case may be. It's sad, but how beautiful really it all is. That attitude of a mother of forgiveness and the love, the unconditional love of a child, and that actually brings me to the number four, which is selflessness. God is selfless, and so are mothers. Mothers are too. God is selfless and mothers are too. I have two passages that we're going to turn to. Actually, three, and then we're going to end this up. In John 3, verse 16. John 3, verse 16, this is a well-known passage. We're going to turn to it anyway. John 3, verse 16. And then we're going to turn to 1 John 3, verse 16. John 3, verse 16, then 1 John 3, verse 16. All of you probably know what John 3:16 says. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. God lovingly, selflessly, the Father, let his son die. He did. The Word, who had always lived, he let him die for us. 1 John 3, verse 16. 1 John 3, verse 16. It's interesting how these coordinate, John 3, 16, and then 1 John 3, 16. One is talking about the Father. This one is talking about the Son, how he gave his own life up. 1 John 3, verse 16. Where am I at? There I am. 1 John 3:16, by this we know love, because Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. He says, and we also ought to do the same thing. Lives for our brethren. Our Father showed us his selfless love when he allowed his Son to die for us. And our elder brother Jesus Christ showed us his selfless love when he gave his life so we wouldn't have to. And guess what? God continues to do that on a daily basis. Continue to show us his selfless love. And guess what? A godly mother shows this as well on a daily basis. You know, a mother, I've seen it many times, a mother will give up things so her family can have what they need. She just will. A mother will deny herself a luxury so her children may have it. A mother will deny herself sleep to get up at 3 a.m. in the morning to attend to a crying baby so her husband doesn't have to. I've seen it. I've lived it. I know. A mother will not eat, so her child is able to. I've seen that. A mother is the guard of her household. She is the keeper of her family. Yes, she is a homemaker, whether she is a stay-at-home mom or not. She is the guarder of her home. A true mother is always doing the things that display her selfless love. A true mother, a godly mother, is always doing things that display her selfless love in so many ways, and I might add, even to death. You can read articles of mothers that have given their lives for their children, shielding their children, protecting their children. They say that mothers don't fear death. They say their greatest fear is leaving their children in this world knowing no one will love them like she does. I believe that. I truly do. A mother's unconditional love is amazing to witness, and I believe that all of us have witnessed it in one time or another. This type of love is the love of our great God, and that is what our mothers, that is what they display. You know, mothers are truly special, and a real mother reveals the side of God we don't normally discuss. It's tender. It's delicate. And it is really actually quite amazing. After all, she was made in his image as well. One day the world will see and understand why a woman is a woman and a man is a man. They'll understand that. And they will realize that both man and woman make up and reveal who God really is. That's what they'll see. I have one more passage, like I said, Revelation 21. I want to end here. Revelation 21, verse 3. Says, and I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, and there shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. How motherly is that? You know, the world will one day see that gentle, compassionate, caring, selfless hand of God. It says, no longer crying tears. I don't think it'll be tears of grief. There may be tears of joy and happiness. That's the best tears that can be shed. Ask a mother, and she'll tell you so. So as you celebrate Mother's Day this year, think about the attributes your mother displays. And I would bet that they are that of gentleness, they are that of compassion and care, and they are that of selflessness. Don't forget to tell her how grateful you are. How grateful you are for her. And don't grieve her, kids. Don't grieve your mother. To all the mothers and to all the women who fill that mother's role, I hope all of you have a wonderful Mother's Day.